I'm Nick Gillespie. I'm editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason.tv, and I'm joined by my colleague, Matt Welch.
Thanks for not saying esteemed. I appreciate that.
We'll give it time. I don't think you're drinking enough to be esteemed yet. So, but we are here to talk about the long-term implications of the midterm elections, and we have as our panelists, along with ourselves, Kristen Soltis, who's director of policy research at the Winston Group, D.C. area consulting and polling outfit, and David Kirby of the Institute for Humane Studies, who was also for a time the leader of the America's Future Foundation, and also has written along with David Bowes and several other researchers a lot of stuff about the libertarian vote, which we find very interesting, particularly at Reason. What we're going to do tonight is each of the two panelists are each going to talk for about 3 to 5 minutes and kind of give a quick sense of what happened in the midterms and what they think is down the road. Then Matt and I will ask them a couple of questions, then we'll turn it over to you, and we'll have hopefully a fun and spirited conversation. Before we get started, Reason, as many of you know, started in 1968 as a publication based in Boston. It's now technically headquartered in Los Angeles, and it's a nonprofit foundation. We're running a webathon this week, so if you would like to donate to our cause, we would appreciate that, certainly. But tomorrow we're actually having one of our semi-annual Board of Trustees meetings, and so before we get started, I wanted to particularly point out that the president of Reason Foundation, David Nott, is here, as well as the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Bill Dunn, as well as a number of our trustees, and I was hoping that we could have the trustees stand up to be acknowledged by the crowd. So thank you very much. And without further ado, Kristen, would you like to give us your rundown of what happened in
sure
the midterms?
As a pollster, I like to look at things through numbers, and so a lot of times in the media, you'll see big stories pop up, and they'll seem to be the most important story of the day. All of a sudden, there will be something that will happen in Arizona, and immigration will become very, very, very important, or there will be the BP oil spill, and suddenly energy and the environment will become very, very important. But throughout this last election cycle, the economy has been the top issue, overriding pretty much everything else. Particularly as we got right up toward the election, you saw voters in surveys that we at the Winston Group had done and in other surveys that the economy was the top issue for over half of voters. And the sort of analogy that we like to use is that it was like it's as if the economy was like a house that's on fire, or that the country, it's like a house that's on fire. You can say that, you know, you need to fix the healthcare system. You can say you need to fix our immigration policy. You can say you need to fix all of these other things in the way that you could say you need to repaint a house, or you need to, you know, put new carpeting in, something like that. But really, the unemployment rate was this fire. And until you fixed the economic indicators, particularly the joblessness rate, voters were going to focus almost exclusively on the economy. And until the economy was fixed, Barack Obama's approval ratings were going to stay low, and Democrats were going to have a really big uphill battle going into this election. And so what you saw on Election Day was the result of independents in particular breaking heavily toward Republican candidates across the country. And this was largely because of economic issues. You also saw in the exit polls a sort of historic change in the ideological makeup of the country. Traditionally, moderates have outnumbered conservatives by healthy single digits or margins. And in this last election, you saw conservatives make up 42% of the vote. It was an 8% jump over the previous election, which is only similar to the change between like 92 and 94, where you saw a 7% jump. And conservatives now actually outnumber moderates. So it was that sort of emphasis of the fact that America, you know, people say America is a center-right country. But on economic issues, that really is the case, that in this election that was very dominated by the economy, folks coming out said they were conservative, and even independents were saying that they didn't trust Democrats to handle the economy anymore. They gave it back to the Republicans. And I think that the challenge for Republicans moving forward is proving to voters that they were justified in giving that they can trust Republicans, that Republicans can be trusted to govern, can be capable of governing in an effective way. And that's something that somebody like Speaker Boehner is really going to have, that's his big challenge, is how do you get the Tea Party and the rest of his caucus together on board to govern effectively in the next 2 years.
Thanks very much, Kristen. David?
Well, I also noticed, like Kristen did, that the big story here is that this election was really about ideology. Many pollsters are saying, wow, this is a big conservative uptick. The research that I've been doing actually shows that maybe it's not quite the whole story, this conservative uptick. In particular, what I want to talk about briefly is the Tea Party. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And what does it mean for libertarians? So in my research, we actually conducted some exit polls of actual Tea Party rallies, which are different and important in an important way. If you call somebody up on the telephone and do a poll and say, are you a supporter of the Tea Party? Well, that's kind of an easy thing to say. But if you actually show up at the rally, it's plausible that you kind of have a different kind of motivation for being there. So we kind of went to those rallies to actually do some studies to see who shows up. And the big story is that half the people who show up at these Tea Party rallies are libertarian, not conservative, not traditional conservatives. That's important for a couple reasons. First, Republicans are in danger of misreading what this mandate says. This election was not a mandate for Republicans. It was not a mandate for traditional conservatism. The energy and anger of the Tea Party was actually focused very much on economic issues, but it did not stray to the social conservative issues. The people who we surveyed who would identify themselves as more libertarian, they're not there because of gay marriage, they're not there because of abortion, they're there because of spending, bailouts, their anger about what's going on in Washington. And that, I think, on the whole, is a good thing for libertarians. One particular point that I found in our survey of a Virginia Tea Party rally that I think is worth celebrating is the word libertarian still remains very unfamiliar to most people who hold libertarian beliefs. Pollsters, when they ask the traditional question, are you liberal, are you conservative, are you moderate, libertarians don't quite know what to say. So most of the time they say they're independent, or they say they're moderate, or often reluctantly they'll tick the box conservative, even though that's not really what they are. So what we did in our survey is we offered people who showed up at the Tea Party an option to tick the box libertarian. And 35% of the people who we say would be libertarian actually tick the box and self-identify as libertarian. That's the largest number that we've seen in any surveys that we've conducted to date. Now, that's only one data point, but nationally, typically you find people self-identify in the 1 to 2% libertarian range. So this might be a great thing for the libertarian brand. If the energy and excitement of this election was driven by half of the Tea Party who are libertarians and they're starting to use the word to self-identify, that actually might be a really good sign looking forward that there's kind of hope for this kind of ideology that we talk about here at Reason and Cato and otherwise, that's different than the kind of conservative trend that you were picking up on, Kristen.
David, you've been doing research at Cato for a while, talking about the kind of libertarian bloc, which I think you guys have put it somewhere around 14% fiscally conservative, socially moderate.
That's right. Not
necessarily self-identifying. Has that number changed at all? Have you seen the number swell in 2010 in particular? And have you yet seen, and can you walk everyone through, because it's kind of interesting, how that bloc, how the voting enthusiasms have changed from 2000, 2002, and coming up now?
It's probably a familiar story to most of you, but yes, the libertarian bloc is estimated between 15 and 20%. The polling that we've seen that's coming out of the 2010 election show that there's not a real big uptick in the number of libertarians, but I think their importance and their self-identity and the arguments that they've been making are catching on. The story goes basically that libertarians vote like Republicans when Republicans do the right thing. So in 2000, they actually voted about 70% for Republicans. But in 2004, 2006, when libertarians saw the spending in excess of Republicans, they started to swing away from Republicans. So they went from a 70% voting block for Republicans to more like a 55% voting block. And there are more independent-minded blocks, so they're part of the swing vote that really changes the dynamics in an election. So in 2010, we are again seeing libertarians swing away from Democrats back to Republicans, but it shouldn't be interpreted as a vote of confidence in Republicans. Instead, it's a sign that we don't like any of the above, and we're mad as hell, and we've been saying this for 10 years, and nobody's listening. It's kind of like the steaming anger has been stewing for 10 years, and suddenly it kind of erupts. And that's why I think it's really exciting that so many of these people have found the Tea Party as a place to organize. Traditional conservatives, they've had gun clubs, the Christian Coalition, churches to organize around. Where have libertarians gone? Well, right now they have half the Tea Party, and I think that's a good sign.
Kristen, Nick and I have been writing about, and it's going to be part of the subject of our book, is the long-term growth of independents as a bloc from something like 19% in 1970, according to the Harris Poll, to more like 30, 33% now. Did that trend continue through 2010, or did independents say, okay, we're going to be conservatives or Republicans for this election, and how much of their loyalty is swinging back and forth right now?
Well, independents have swung back and forth pretty dramatically in terms of who they voted for. Independents voted pretty dramatically for Democratic candidates in 2006 and then in 2008, and now have swung back the other direction.
By pretty dramatically, you mean like 56 to 40, or what was the...
We won independents by 19 points this year, which is...
I'm sorry, who's we?
Independents won by... Republicans won independents by 19 points this year, which after having lost them in the teens in previous elections is a very big swing. An interesting fact that most folks don't know is that in both 2006 and 1994, Republicans made up the same percent of the electorate, about 36% of the electorate, and they broke for Republican candidates about the same way. The difference there was that independent candidates in 94 broke for Republicans in the high teens, and in 2006 broke for Democrats in the high teens. These big swing elections don't happen because of turnout. Consultants will tell you it's turnout usually. Pundits a lot of times will say it was turnout, our base was excited. But it's not about the base, it's about these independents. And this time around, they broke for Republicans heavily. And actually, this election, what you've seen since 2002, over the last few elections, the percentage of the electorate that says they're independent has increased in each of those last four elections. So you're seeing a lot of folks, as a result of that frustration that David talked about, are saying that they've washed their hands with both parties and they're looking for someone, anyone, who can be an adult, prove they're ready to govern, and that they're not wedded to one party or another to give them solutions. They just want to see someone present solutions that they believe are effective.
Kristen, can I follow up also briefly? You said that people were, you know, the economy was the main issue and that people are ready to have the Republicans take another shot. Obviously, they can't do very much, you know, simply as holding, a majority in the House. So come 2012, does any of this mean anything, or is it clear what it would mean if the economy rebounds? Do the Republicans get credit no matter what, or do the Democrats, or is that still like something that you can't even begin to understand?
It's tough. I would be inclined to say it's something you can't even begin to understand, just because we're in such a bizarre period right now where you've seen change of control of the House of Representatives flip pretty dramatically in a very short period of time. Normally, folks have at least a couple cycles where they're in control of a House of Congress before they lose it, and this has been kind of dramatic. So in that sense, I would say we could be headed into new territory. On the other hand, it really comes down to the president. And if you look at political science going back decades and decades and decades, economic indicators are one of the greatest things that can tell you whether or not a president is going to get reelected or not. So if the economy rebounds over the next 2 years, there's a chance Republicans could get credit for it if Republicans have done something to prove that they should get credit for it. But if Republicans have not done anything to prove that they have tried to govern effectively or that they deserve that credit, then Barack Obama will be the one that benefits.
What, will it be a replay of the 96 election with Clinton, where the Republicans maintain control of the House and Senate, and you reelect a president who 2 years before everybody was writing off as a one-termer?
Well, one of the things that'll be interesting about the House is you've got redistricting that's going to happen between now and the 2012 elections, and Republicans picked up control of governor's houses and state legislatures in many critical areas, so where you're going to see, I think Republicans will still have a good shot in 2012, even if their economy rebounds and Democrats put their coalition back together. But with all of that said, I really think that I think that the Obama administration has shown that they are not necessarily as politically nimble as the Clinton administration was. That Bill Clinton was able to take that loss to Newt Gingrich and retool, figure out how to come back and make himself someone who, you know, he could work with Newt Gingrich. And he wound up looking really good out of that. I think this time around you're seeing something very different. Obama has not proven himself to be a centrist president. And meanwhile, when Republicans on election night gave their speeches, it wasn't the sort of boisterous, excited, we're ready to storm the castle and do all sorts of radical things that you may have seen in 94 with Newt Gingrich's very excited speeches when he was when the wave happened. This time around, you saw Republicans that, at least in their speeches, sounded very chastened. They said, you know, we realize we've been given a second chance, but you saw Marco Rubio in Florida saying this was not a vote because people love Republicans. I think that if Republicans aren't just saying that, if they really get it, if they really believe it, they have a shot to govern in a way that could help them in 2 years.
Before we turn it over to the audience, I just wanted to follow up real quick. David, so the kind of new energized electorate seems to be more libertarian than other things. What do you make, and what do you think Tea Party people will make of somebody like Jim DeMint, who was really one of the architects of a lot of Senate wins, and the first big statement he says coming out of the gate is about social issues? Is that a good indicator or a bad indicator?
I mean, what he said that's important and it's something to grapple with is there is no such thing as a fiscal conservative who is not also a social conservative, which is, in the Senate, maybe it's true. Right? I mean, that's the thing. It's not true in this audience. It's not true necessarily in the country. But, you know, is it in fact true even with this sort of historic wave election?
I mean, from our data, I don't think that's going to wash very well with at least half the Tea Party. So we asked the question for the people who showed up at the Tea Party, which is the politician you most identify with the Tea Party? The libertarian half, say Ron Paul, and the conservative half, say Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, or Jim DeMint, or other types of people like that. So while Jim DeMint may get half of the kind of Tea Party energy on his side, he's likely going to antagonize with that type of statement the libertarian half of the Tea Party. That's why I think it's actually important for Republicans to recognize that they don't have a unified block here. The Tea Party is a much more complicated story than the media is letting people on to believe. It's not just a fake kind of arch-conservative ginned up by, you know, billionaire funders. It's actually has an authentic kind of half that is legitimately libertarian. So I think that's the kind of message that Republicans can trip themselves up with if they continue to go with it.
Matt, do you want to...
Let's open it up to
questions. Yeah, and we're going to try and get off the stage and without...
I wasn't having any trouble.
Yeah. Okay, very good.
We're going to...
And if you could stand up when you are asking a question, stand up and identify yourself and actually ask a question in a fairly expeditious fashion.
Meredith, how are we doing on this mic? We're going to be okay? I'm going to privilege Bob Poole.
Thanks. Bob Poole, my question is for either of you. Some months ago, the New York Times published a front page story on their assessment of the demographics of the Tea Party movement, which was shocking to most people because it wasn't at all the liberal media portrayal. It was of people above average income and education. But I don't remember, could either of you assess in their demographic assessment how libertarian or how social conservative was what they found in that study?
The New York Times didn't actually ask questions that tried to probe that. That's why we've been trying to include and encourage other pollsters to include a set of questions that can pull this apart. Because when you actually go and talk to people, you can hear it. But unless you actually ask those questions on a poll, you'll miss it. So we've been encouraging people to ask a question like, do you believe the federal government should promote traditional values or promote no particular set of values? That question kind of pulls apart this kind of libertarian conservative dynamic, the people who say traditional conservatives, they're there, and the libertarians otherwise. So the New York Times, I don't think, has captured that with the polls, and they've been the kind of stalwart there, so Washington Post and others have missed the story as well.
One of the reasons why you saw this media narrative develop, that the Tea Party was, you know, in addition to being fiscally conservative, also very socially conservative, not only was it sort of convenient, but I mean, what it really did is it was neglecting the fact that because the economy was the top issue, that was the thing that's getting people out to rallies. So even if half of the Tea Party is socially conservative, that wasn't what was motivating people to show up to rally. So to the extent, I mean, for instance, when I say that 42% of the electorate identified as conservative this time around, that's not necessarily, again, to say that that means that they're all socially conservative. And I would posit that because the economy was so critical, that it really just shows that economic conservatism is what made a jump here. I wouldn't necessarily say there's anything to show that social conservatism, that there was anything to push people to consider themselves conservatives on that axis.
Thank you. Mandy Klausner, Reason Foundation. So two narrow questions. Kristen, you mentioned that the big overriding issue is the unemployment level. How much did your figure show sensitivity or anger based on the healthcare legislation, both substantively and procedurally? So that's, hold that for a second. And this, the question for David is, when you talked about the study you did, you said of the Virginia Tea Party, was it more than one event? Is it published? Is that something that's available?
So I guess I'll jump in first. The healthcare bill was something that really began to galvanize, I think, the Tea Party. This is when you first began to see folks turning up at town halls back in August of 2009, yelling at their members of Congress. They were fed up and they weren't taking it anymore. And it was really driven by this healthcare bill. This was, you had TARP that was a big price tag. And then you had the stimulus that was another big price tag. And this is when people started to wake up. They started realizing, you would hear the government throw around big numbers. This is how much the cost of the war in Iraq. This is how much X and Y and Z cost. And all of a sudden these big $800 billion, these numbers started popping up and people got nervous. And when you heard how much the healthcare bill was going to cost, it was that sticker shock that really sent people, they were frustrated. And they all turned out to these town halls, and that was when you saw the Tea Party begin to get attention from the national media. We did a survey, a post-election survey, where we asked folks, do you support or oppose the healthcare bill? And independents, by a pretty significant margin, opposed Barack Obama's healthcare bill. But we further asked a question: would you rather see the first bill that a Republican Congress tackles, would you rather see it be a job creation bill, or would you rather see a repeal and replace effort? And independents and Democrats, the electorate overall, says job creation by a very large margin. The difference is you see the Tea Party, they pick repeal and replace. It's one of the things that somebody like John Boehner is going to have to figure out is what do you do first when you've got a Tea Party movement that is, or when you've got a conservative wing that's very focused on repealing and replacing this healthcare bill, and the fact that you didn't get elected because of that, you got elected in large part because these economic issues, a subset of which would be the spending and other fiscal issues, of which healthcare is obviously a big part, but it's the healthcare bill, I think, is what brought the Tea Party to prominence, but the economy has got to be the first thing that gets tackled.
And the question for me was, is it published? Is it one survey, two surveys, or what? We published it with the Cato Institute. We did an op-ed in Politico where you can find some of the summary of our findings. The survey that we did was in Virginia, yes, but it actually replicated the methodology of another survey that was done in Washington, D.C. So you sort of have two local data points. And then we added to that a national data point. The Washington Post was kind enough to include some questions on their survey that was able to help us pull apart the same trend. And they've also found that people who supported or leaned to the Tea Party nationally were split between, on the social issues, half and half libertarian conservative.
I want to pivot off of something that Kristen said about Terry Michael, libertarian Democrat, six of us in America. Pivot off something Kristen said about how nimble Democratic operatives are. And I think the Bill Clinton moment occurred today, and big government is over. David Axelrod said, we're going to give those greedy rich people their tax cuts like these Reason trustees behind me. I think that is really significant. I think it's significant in what Obama said in his Rolling Stone interview, that he gave props to thoughtful libertarians. I think maybe I'm seeing it through my libertarian rose-colored glasses. I think maybe they got the damn message.
I'm sorry, it's the Democrat rose-colored glasses that you're seeing that through.
What I would say is that in the press conference, the day after Election Day, Savannah Guthrie from MSNBC asked this question, President Obama, it just seems like you're not getting it. Or is it possible to assert that you're just not getting it? And I thought his answer back was a little bit weak. And I think that what really will matter is not necessarily these the statements that they're making right now, but What happens on the first day that John Boehner is speaker, or the first, you know, what happens when this new Congress is in session and Obama really has to deal with it? Are they going to work together, or is he going to sort of pursue an agenda that is unpalatable? Now, you could also argue that Republicans might want to stonewall everything that he does, but I think because you're seeing so much frustration and things are so bad, Americans don't have an appetite for someone who just wants to do nothing and stop everything. They want solutions. They want someone who will say something that will make something better. And so in that sense, if Obama does not present anything that the American people think is credibly acceptable or is an actual attempt at bipartisanship, I think they'll continue to see him as this far-left liberal. The one of the questions that we ask in our surveys is, we say, on a scale of 1 to 9, do you view where do you place yourself if 1 is liberal and 9 is conservative? We ask, you know, where would you place Barack Obama? Where would you place Nancy Pelosi? Where would you place Fox News, et cetera, et cetera? We find that generally the overall electorate places themselves to the right of 5, between like 5 and 6. You find that independents place themselves near 6, and you find they place Barack Obama at about like a 3.5. So the electorate really believes he's pretty far to the left, and that's something he's got to work on. He ran on this sort of centrist hope and change, and he's got to get back to that.
Hey, Marcus Miller, self-proclaimed, I guess, reactionary conservative. From that standpoint, probably be the easiest way to describe it, who's been fascinated with the libertarian movement for a good year and a half now. Took my buddy Mike to actually bring me out to one of these, and I'm absolutely fascinated by this discussion. That's a two-part question that's really going to sort of bring you guys away from the stats, so to speak, because I'm really trying to figure out, you know, what exactly 2012 is going to look like. We've discussed before how there's a different type of independent that showed up for this particular election. I know from research and history, of course, a different type of independent always shows up for a midterm election. So my two-part question would be, what does the 2012 independent look like based upon the factors that, you know, we've established up to this point? I know it's tough to project what the economy is going to look like in a couple of years, but basically asking you guys what that sort of independent looks like, and more importantly, whether or not the libertarian section of the Tea Party movement can and should be able to impact the Republican candidate for presidency in 2012.
So I'll answer the first part and then chew on the second while Kristen answers if I come back to it. So what does the independent bloc look like in 2012? I'll answer just one part of it, which is something that I've been thinking about, is what do young people do in 2012, but we haven't talked about that demographic yet. Young people are much more independent-minded. They definitely don't like the Republican Party. They tried out Barack Obama. Even libertarian young people tried out Barack Obama. They got swept up in that culture movement, but not as many of them showed up this time. What happens to them? You know, everyone thinks that once young people vote in 2 consecutive elections for the same party, they're locked in for life. Well, we had one. What happens the second one around? My guess is that young people are looking at the unemployment and they're feeling that pain, you know, particularly acutely. I mean, they grew up in a time of relative peace and prosperity. They expect great jobs when they do all the right things. And then you see stories about, you know, young people who went through Yale who are on food stamps in New York, you know, hipsters on food stamps. Like, how do they reconcile that, you know? I think people like us have an interesting story to tell there, which is you have to probe deeper and understand where that peace and prosperity that you've come to take for granted comes from. So I'm somewhat optimistic that the energy in the Tea Party, it's not a young person's thing. I mean, the Tea Party is definitely 45 to 65. It's not cool like that. But young people, well, I mean, in all seriousness, young people don't see it that way. So how will young people react? That's a real question mark. I'm hopeful that they'll start to pick the pieces up together.
Yeah, to your question about what independence will look like, if the economy is still bad, then independence will still be these sort of economic conservatives. You know, the stimulus didn't work. This isn't the right direction. If the economy gets better, then I think you know, independence will... I have no idea what they'll look like. You know, it'll depend. To be frank with you, it'll depend entirely on what sorts of national issues are popping at the time. You know, you just never know when something's going to happen, where a state passes an immigration law that's controversial, or when there's an oil spill in the Gulf that can change things. It's this time around, the economy drove out everything else. 2 years from now, it's very difficult to project what will be motivating those independent voters. But they really are the key. to whomever wants to win in 2012. Again, both parties are going to be saying, you know, Obama needs to rally his base. He needs to get African Americans and young voters and Hispanics and women back on board. And it is true that he lost support among young voters, or that Democrats did not do as well as Obama did in this election. You know, women voted, I believe Republicans won women by like 1 point, a very small margin, but that's a big deal. So Obama's got to put that coalition back together in 2012. And while I have no idea what voters or what independents will be motivated by at the time, if the economy is still sluggish, I anticipate it'll be same as now.
And let me pipe in about the libertarian influence on the Republican presidential candidate. I think what we saw last time around, I mean, John McCain was a terrible presidential candidate. It was like a redo of Bob Dole. I mean, an old man who, you know, had waited his turn or whatever, but had no juice whatsoever. The guy who really catalyzed and crystallized something different for the Republican message and got a lot of young people out, as well as changed the terms of debate, was Ron Paul, who was like a hardcore, you know, as libertarian as a national politician is going to get. I mean, the guy ran as the LP's candidate in 1988. I think when you look around now, you see people in, you know, and it's all glimmerings, but, you know, there's somebody like Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who is feeling things out. He's got Ron Paul's, sign on him. People like Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, who has said, we need to have a truce on social issues. That's not what's important. That's not where things are going. When you start to look at what's going on in California, where marijuana legalization was put to a vote and it got over 40% of the population saying, yeah, let's do this, people are not uptight in the same way about social issues that they used to be. So I think if the Republican Party wants to win in 2012, they're going to have to start looking long and hard at a focus on libertarian issues, which is not to say you can't be a social conservative in your personal life, but that's not the province of politics. So I think that's where a good libertarian candidate goes, you know, in the Republican Party.
Before I get the next questioner, I think I have the right to ask the next questioner a question. Norm Singleton works for Ron Paul. Is Ron Paul running for president in 2012?
I don't know. I'm actually surprised that you didn't ask if his son is running in 2016. That might be, not that I have any inside knowledge, but that could be a more interesting question to ask.
Well, that'll be if Aqua Buddha gives him the right to do so, right?
Well, I think we saw that Aqua Buddhism beats witchcraft among Republican voters and independents this election. Yeah. My question for David and anybody else who wants to take it is, when you talk about the Tea Party being the age of the Tea Party, of the average Tea Party participant, and then their big issue is debt, and then you look at the Sarah Palin wing of the Tea Party, and you look at what is the three big issues that are areas that are causing the debt, it's not discretionary non-defense spending since 08. It's defense, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And while I don't think it's true that anyone actually carried a sign at one of the Tea Party rallies against the health care bill saying, don't let the government take over Medicare, it is true that at least historically, even the most fiscally conservative senior citizens voter have said, cut everything but keep your hands off of Medicare. How do you see, have you done any studies that show that there's a recognition that, at least for our generation, that we can't just continue on the entitlement state, and a recognition that we just can't continue to have, you don't have to adopt Ron Paul's foreign policy, but at the very least, you can't continue to take the Heritage Foundation's position that not only should we not cut defense, but we should guarantee it's 7% of the of GDP.
So are older Tea Party people going to be supportive of massive entitlement cuts? My thought is yes, and here's why. What I've been able to detect in some of the polls and also with interviews of Tea Party people is a strong multi-generational concern. I mean, they don't really think about those issues down to the point, is it Medicaid and how much percentage do we cut for defense? It's not really about that. It's for the first time they think about their children and grandchildren as living in a world that's not as prosperous and don't have the opportunities that they did, that America is on a decline. And that makes them mad as hell. So it really is motivated by this kind of multi-generational concern. So if that's the premise, it seems to me that it's more likely that people who are motivated by that concern would be willing to live with cuts for the stuff for themselves to preserve the prosperity for their kids. And so you see that, you pick that up very strongly in the polls, this kind of multi-generational concern. So that gives me a little bit of hope that we're not completely lost on entitlement cuts.
I don't want to be the killjoy. I'm not as optimistic as David. One of the things that we've been talking about how the Tea Party is economically conservative, but I would actually step back from that and say that it's not as simple even as that label. For instance, Pew just came out with some results that showed that the Tea Party is overwhelmingly not in favor of free trade. The Tea Party is a little more complex than David's research has obviously shown it's a lot more complex than the mainstream media gives it credit for. In terms of a younger generation being more willing to see cuts in things like entitlements, Zogby did some research, I believe it was like 2 or 3 years ago, where they asked young people, do you believe that you will ever see Social Security and Medicare? Do you believe that you will ever receive any of these benefits? And do you believe your children ever will? And it was something in the low teens of people under the age of 30 who thought they'd ever see a Social Security check. So young people understand that this is just unsustainable. I mean, that has been made. The big problem is how do you explain to an electorate, beyond the folks who read Reason Magazine or are, you know, strong libertarians and understand intuitively why we can't continue down this path, how do you explain to folks why cuts in their benefits actually make the country better and actually might make their lives better as a result? It's a really difficult argument to make, especially to make in a soundbite, and unfortunately in our political discourse these days, it's tough to take 20 minutes to sit voters down and say, okay, here's why we really need to rethink the way we're doing our entitlements. So unfortunately, I'm not as optimistic. What makes me optimistic is that young people do seem to get it. They're not necessarily going out and voting because of Medicare or Social Security. They're much more likely to, in this election, for instance, vote because the unemployment rate for young people is atrocious. But I would caution people who believe that the Tea Party is a sign that entitlement reform is a slam dunk, because you've still got a lot of sort of fractured beliefs and different influences pulling on people that are causing them not necessarily to have the ideologically pure set of issue positions.
I think it's also interesting to think about, that the Tea Party isn't a stable entity over time. We covered the first Tea Party rally here a year ago and then the one this time, and there was definitely a different flavor and sensibility to the crowd. It was picking up a lot more the second time. It was a much smaller crowd for the Freedom Works one, but also one that was clearly more socially conservative, it seemed to me, at least in the signage and the people we talked to. But also entitlements aren't, young people might be like, think about it. If you're 20 years away from Social Security or Medicare, and if you haven't like gone with your parents through the Medicare bills when they came in, you have no idea what it means really. And I'm more than willing, younger people are more than willing to say, oh yeah, screw that. Who cares? But now that Pell Grants are entitlements or more other programs that affect them immediately, it'll be interesting to see if young Tea Party people or anti-government people, anti-entitlement spending people are willing to say, yeah, let's get rid of student loans, government student loans, let's get rid of government Pell Grants and all this stuff that's coming to my pocket. I also think that the Republican or Democrat, the politician who comes up with an exit strategy from entitlement spending will win the day, because that's what we need. And you can see that even in the private sector and the public sector of shifting out of defined benefit pension plans into defined contributions. The unions are starting to do that. The UAW did that. Other public sector jobs are. And you need to do that just as an economic reality, but it probably will never be politically that popular.
I think we have time for one more that I see. Shirley's forfeiting your... Does someone feel more strongly than Shirley?
Hi, Steve Fritzinger. It seems like every 4 years, the libertarian movement pins its hopes on somebody. Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Gary Johnson, you know, it's all on this one guy's shoulders, and it never works. If you look back to the run-up to the 18th Amendment, the Prohibition movement had been around for decades with Carrie Nation and all of them. They never really got anywhere with 10 to 15% of the vote. Then along came Wayne Wheeler and the Anti-Saloon League with a laser-like focus on one issue and very strategically picking off vulnerable House members and senators over a period of elections. And in like 10 years, they managed to pass one of the dumbest ideas in American history. Why can't we get past this one person kind of a philosophy and get into that kind of a long-term strategy that would actually produce results with our 15%?
I think he wins the questions.
No offense.
I mean, I guess I have, I'll try one type of answer. I sort of have a Hayekian view of social change in the sense of it requires not just
one. I hope that's Salma Hayek, because F.A. Hayek isn't winning a lot of votes either.
Right, so. Right. Although his book is very popular. There's a lot of overlapping memberships and affiliations and kind of clusters of people who will come together to push it. So I don't think it's just a one candidate, one issue type of thing. And what is making me optimistic is that libertarians have more options to join things that are relevant today than they ever had before. I mean, when the Ron Paul campaign cropped up, that was it. But now there's the Tea Party, now there's Campaign for Future, there's things like Reason, there's things like Cato. There's places for people to go and find other libertarians. That actually is somewhat different, perhaps, than, I mean, I don't my memory doesn't serve too far back in the kind of libertarian party lore, so I can't completely comment beyond that. But it seems to me that when you have multiple overlapping kind of groups that are all kind of pushing in the same direction, that's a good sign that you might actually get some change.
What I would say to that is that as we move forward, young people, by and large, they, in the previous election, weren't necessarily economic conservatives, and in fact, by voting largely for Barack Obama, there's this question that Pew likes to ask every few years where they say, it's pretty much, do you believe that when the government tends to do things, that it tends to be inefficient and wasteful? And that in the 80s, young people by and large had said yes, and that for kind of the first time in 2006, young people were saying no, that they didn't think that the government tended to be inefficient and wasteful. This was in like 2006, which made me nervous because I had always, you know, the conventional wisdom I had pinned my hope on was that young people just wanted the government out of their way, low taxes, my best friend is gay, I don't like the idea that you know, et cetera, that young people were a natural audience for libertarians. I had been nervous when I saw that Pew number, but I think the overall electorate this time around has really, as long as economic issues remain at the forefront, I think libertarians have a real chance to improve their importance within the Republican Party, within politics in general, I think. You know, the exit polls, I think 56% of people said that the government was trying to do too much or trying to do too many things that it ought not do. I think that's a good sign that in the future, this mindset that is friendly toward libertarianism, it has a future.
It's interesting that you asked that question. I was just talking with libertarian Democrat Terry Michael just before this thing. We were talking about Prop 19 along those lines. Like, it's only going to start really working when you get to fire Dianne Feinstein for being the freaking chair of the anti-Prop 19 campaign like she was, even though Democratic base overwhelmingly supports marijuana legalizations. Democrats have not been punished for that in a way that until recently Republicans really hadn't been punished for straying from fiscal conservatism. And that's kind of new, and that has reshaped the Republican Party for the moment, right? We don't know how it's going to look like, you know, 10 days from now, whether John Boehner's going to stop crying long enough to do anything useful in his life. But if, you know, I think along those lines, that's when you finally get people's attention, when you say, we will punish you. We will fire your establishment guy and get a crazy person to run if the crazy person agrees with us. I think that's a great solution for all of us.
And, you know, also to put a plug in for the book Matt and I are working on, which will be out next year, called The Declaration of Independence, how ENTS, how libertarian politics can help fix what's wrong with America, something like that. But, you know, to go to your point, I mean, what I think you're seeing among a kind of libertarian impulse in America is it's not relying on one person, that you're not going to, you know, have somebody get one electoral vote and, you know, wow, everything will change. But we've seen a social learning curve. I mean, Bob Poole, who is one of the, and Manny Klausner is here, two of the founders of Reason Magazine. You know, the magazine's been around since 68, the party since 70 or 71. It's relatively new in terms of, you know, developing a sensibility along with places like Cato, IHS. You know, you can run through a series of libertarian organizations that are all, you know, about 30, 35 years old. And, you know, just as there are social learning curves when it comes to investing, when it comes to living on your own as opposed to under a king or whatever, I think you're starting to see a more broad-based libertarian ethos infuse the general culture, which tracks along with what's been going on in people's lives. We have more independence now to live how we want to. We have more choices that we can make and that we want to make. Politics, and this is one of the themes of our book, politics is a lagging indicator of American society, and it kind of makes sense that you can now be one of, you know, 10 or 12 gender types. You can buy an infinite number of coffee drinks. You can get, you know, 500 channels on TV. You can surf the net and get more news than you ever could before. And, you know, years after people get used to that and demand that in every part of their life, hopefully they'll understand that that also makes sense in politics, and that we need a wider variety of choices, or we need a government that does less so that we can actually make those choices more clearly in our individual lives.
And if you think about it, yes, I'm sorry to interrupt his applause, but not really.
2012.
You know, it's the people that everyone wants to, the politicians right now want to attract and woo, are now independents. That is it. I mean, that's an incredible swing vote in just 2 years, let alone 4 or 10 or anything like that. That is the pendulum, and that group more or less continues to grow. It's, you know, again, grown by half in 40 years, and there's no reason to expect it not to keep growing as long as you have these two parties which agree on a lot of things that are unpopular in the rest of the country. Bailout economics is a great example. That's been unpopular every step of the way, and yet there's been a bipartisan support for it. So if you make yourself the swing vote, suddenly you have a lot more power than if you're sort of a kept member of a shrinking tent.
And if, you know, if you think about it, this is one of the examples that we use, but, you know, and people were talking about brands and whatnot, you know, just in the past decade or so, we've seen things like Oldsmobile disappear, Pontiac is no longer being made, Saturn, Plymouth is gone. You know, older brands like Republican and Democrats, those parties may never go away, but they are dissipating, and what it will mean to be a Democrat or a Republican, if they are still the major parties, has got to change from what it is now, which is not all that different from what it was 20 years ago. And I think that we'll start to see more velocity and volatility in politics, just as Kristen was talking about. I mean, the swing in the House of Representatives, I mean, it's basically been, what, like 4 years, and which is strange, you know, that you would have a turnover to go from one party to another back to the other. So hopefully we'll see less brand loyalty among voters, which increases independence, which increases the possibility of a government being less overbearing in all of its actions.
And I think with that, we should wrap up here so that you have an opportunity to have booze. Go ahead and clap now, but it's not for Nick.
We still do have food and drink. Please stick around until we kick you out. Thank you all for coming, and I want to especially thank Kristen Soltis of the Winston Group, as well as David Kirby of the Institute for Humane Studies. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.